Good morning. For he has not subjected to angels the world to come that we are talking about, but someone somewhere has testified, "What is man that you remember him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him lower than the angels for a short time. You crowned him with glory and honor and subjected everything under his feet. For in subjecting everything to him, he left nothing that is not subject to him. As it is, we do not yet see everything subjected to him. But we do see Jesus, made lower than the angels for a short time, so that by God's grace he might taste death for everyone, crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death."
Thank you, Brandy. If you have your Bible and you want to turn to Hebrews 2, that is where we will be this morning. You know, I attended a small conference last weekend, and there's a fellow there who's really, really good with the Old Testament and really, really good with the Hebrew, or the original language that the Old Testament is written in. And he made this really bold statement. He said, "I really think that there is a lot of grace going on in the Old Testament." Now, if you've been around a church a lot, sometimes we find that hard to believe, but it's true. Would you pray with me? Holy One, maybe it is a modern obsession, this talk of a new world order. It seems that our recent history is full of either the promise or fear of a different way the world will one day work. The truth about these notions is that all that changes is who's in charge. Be it some sinister cabal or those wishing to install a form of Christianity under which the world will be governed, the core of this order is our human attempts to rehab the Adam story, our story. We have this notion that if we could just get back to the garden, all would be well. So we try it through political mechanics, economic philosophies, even movements tied to religion, all to no success. We don't need a new world order. We need a world ordered rightly. And that is what the preacher preaches. The good news is that what we need has been accomplished in Jesus. God, we know it may appear as though it is not the case, but we are looking for change in the same ways we are accustomed, not in the way of Jesus. We ask you to convince us today by your Spirit that the good news is that Jesus, the Messiah, in Jesus, the Messiah, you have inaugurated a different order, not a makeover of the same old order. Remind us that Jesus suffered and died, tasting death for us all, that we all might know of the one now enthroned, rightly ordering life anew. So may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be pleasing in your sight, our rock and our redeemer, and all God's people say. Last June, Emily, I'm going to hope to get this last name right, Giambalvo, that's tough, described the changes coming to college sports for readers of her column in the Washington Post. She wrote this: "The NCAA has long believed college athletes should be amateurs, and that core principle has barred those who compete in this multi-billion dollar industry from profiting off their fame. But after years of discussion and debate, the college sports landscape will soon be rocked by seismic change that allows athletes to receive compensation while competing for their schools." One might argue that this is a new world order for college sports. I mean, it does mean, we're told, that things will change. Recruiting will be different. Long-term commitments to a single college or university will be different. But I'm pretty sure that despite those changes, that in the fall, on nearly every Saturday, there'll be stadiums where two teams get together. They'll put an 11-man squad, offense or defense, out onto that field that's 100 yards long, 53 and a third yards from sideline to sideline, and they'll try to score more points than the other team. A touchdown still worth 6 points. An extra point is going to still be worth a point. And a field goal is still worth 3. Put a different way, though some details change, the order of the game of college football will not change. So no need to be disappointed come this fall. LSU will still play on the field, Alex. Growing up, it wasn't uncommon to hear a lot of warnings of a coming new world order from Christian pulpits, Christian talk shows, or to read the same warnings in Christian periodicals. I remember well as a kid the fear generated by some who attempted to speculate about the details associated with the new to come. Let me make a bold statement all these years later. Any order human beings create, any order human beings create, regardless of their religious affiliation or not, may have new features, may paint itself as new, but in reality, it is nothing new. It may make some preachers popular guests on platforms or talk shows, help sell books, and even impact elections. But the descendants of Adam will always do what the descendants of Adam do. I mean, it's here where we do well to remember the cynical preacher in Ecclesiastes. There is nothing new under the sun. If the congregation hearing the preacher's words found in Hebrews, what we've been going through now, had an interest in angels, God's messengers, literally God's functionaries, that simply means those agents given to carry out whatever God has purposed and planned. If they look to angels because they're tired of suffering and thought that Jesus' suffering was largely unhelpful to alleviate their fatigue, today we seem as susceptible to promises that human ingenuity will do what it has never successfully done for all people, and that is make life better. Why? Because the descendants of Adam will always do what the descendants of Adam do. If there is any hope in something new, it will come from something or someone new that shows up. And that's the preacher's point. The preacher's point here in chapter 2, as we continue to make our way through this letter, Jesus, not angels or Adam's descendants, is the one that orders the world rightly. Jesus is the one that orders the world rightly. We might participate. We may somehow be involved in that project or that process. But that wasn't our idea. It wasn't our goal. It wasn't our aim. It wasn't our mission. God become flesh and blood fills out the full meaning of the psalm. That is the psalm that the preacher refers to. So what the preacher does here, the preacher demonstrates how to read the scriptures the way Jesus read the scriptures. The preacher describes the way that God reconstructs the world rightly in Jesus. And the preacher's determined to counter our wandering, our fatigue, our weariness with the good news of the event that gives us hope. Luke gives us an important reading, an important detail that helps us kind of explain or describe exactly what the preacher is doing here in chapter 2 with Psalm 8. If you remember the last bit of Luke, and Luke's telling the story of Jesus, he tells us about Jesus kind of coming alongside two travelers on their way to Emmaus. And Luke records it this way: "Then beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures." Now remember, in all the scriptures at that particular point was the Old Testament. It was the Hebrew scriptures for many, or it was the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which was popular at the time. Jesus, remember, also told the teachers and the students in his day, "You search the scriptures, for in them you think you have life, but they testify about me." Luke, giving us the detail, Jesus giving it straight, says, listen, if you read the Hebrew scriptures, if you read the Old Testament properly, then you're going to discover me all over the pages. And that's precisely what the preacher is aiming for here in chapter 2. I mean, it is always important to read the passage in its context, what's going on in that day, what's happening when that writer sits down to write that particular passage, that particular place that we refer to. And there's little doubt that the songwriter in the Psalms, there's little doubt that he or she or who, what group, whoever got together and put together this particular song, were one day reflecting on just how awe-struck they were at the realities that human beings had been given such a place in God's design. I mean, if you hear the song that is from chapter 8, you hear these words, "What are human beings that you are mindful of them? Mortals that you care for them? You have made them a little lower than God and crowned them with glory and honor. You have given them dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under their feet." And Psalm 8 is attributed to David. No doubt, the king sitting on his throne, looking around, everything now subject to him as king, and just can't believe that a mere human being is in his place. Looking around and knowing the authority and power of a king to be able to say to servants, "Go and they go, to come and they come." And he's put a song together and just can't believe it. Just can't believe what he sees and what he's experienced, what he's encountered. So he makes a call back to Genesis 1. And it's there in Genesis 1 where we read again this story where God created them male and female and gave them dominion over everything God had created. Human beings made in God's own image and given the instructions to take care of all that they see. The tone is astonishment. Unbelievable awe. Now, the irony can't be lost on you and I. We can't escape that if David is the one who penned this song, the one who is surveying his kingdom and is awestruck by the fact that God has counted him worthy to be king, we also have to admit that David is also such a human being that showed us what it's like when we get that sort of power, when we have that sort of dominion and have that sort of sway. I mean, what we find in the human story, in our story, is that we tend to use what's at our disposal for us, for our best well-being. We might care about our family and a few extended friends, but overall, we really aren't too concerned at what's happening half a continent away in another hemisphere, northern or southern. We tend to be more preoccupied with what we're getting out of the ability that God has given us and not what is available to all people if we exercise our stewardship properly, appropriately. In fact, really, what comes to mind is the irony of David's all over his position, and yet the stories about David where he just seems to not be paying attention to the God who put him on the throne. I mean, looking at David's demise, look at David's end, and he just illustrates that human beings, given all that power and authority, have been weighed, we've been measured, and we've been found wanting. So the preacher does what the preacher does. The preacher preaches the same sermon, amplifying different things in hopes that the congregation gets it. My friend Jason preaches in Northern Virginia, and he was confronted one day on the way out. You know, he was standing at the back of the church, and someone said to him, "You just sound like you're preaching the same sermon over and over again." And he said, "Well, I'm going to keep preaching it until you get it." It appears that he had been reading Hebrews. Because from the very outset, the preacher in Hebrews is determined, doggedly determined, to make sure the congregation knows that all the things that they could consider, the one thing they can't leave out is that God revealed God's self in Jesus. No question. If there's ever a question, pay attention to Jesus. And he takes out after angels because it appears, remember, that they seem enamored of angels. They like the angelic story, not the suffering servant story. Tired and weary and exhausted from persecution and faithfulness and their fellow congregants, tired of it all, they've decided they like the angelic story better. The preacher, aware, keeps persisting. He keeps sounding his one-note sermon. He's going to get his point across over and over and over and over again so that anyone hearing the sermon knows that at the beginning and end of it, it is all about Jesus. So when the preacher takes Psalm 8, fully aware that David is its possible author, fully aware of the awe that we take away from the reality that we have authority over all that we see, naming animals, subduing them, working the land, planting crops. He quotes Psalm 8 from the Septuagint, not the Hebrew. See if you can detect the difference from what I read a moment ago. What are human beings that you are mindful of them, or mortals that you care for them? You have made them for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned them with glory and honor, subjecting all things under their feet. Detect any difference? Sounds awful close. But there is an important difference. In the change from "you have made them a little lower than God," he quotes, "you have made them for a little while lower than the angels." We tend to be enamored of ourselves, often thinking ourselves more than what our history reveals. And the subtle difference emphasized by the preacher points to what Jesus has done for human beings and how God became human for a little while lower than the angels. Where David has in mind human beings, the preacher has in mind Jesus. And he does what Jesus did for the two on the road to Emmaus. And he does what Jesus said is important for those who are teachers and students of the Scriptures. Pay attention because they're telling you something about me. So though they were well aware of Psalm 8 and what it meant to be human and given opportunities and privilege, the preacher wanted them to know that the real human being who fits that bill is Jesus. There's a second difference there that carries this practice further, this practice of interpreting these scriptures and keeping our focus and attention and seeing Jesus. Giving human beings dominion over creation is in the mind of the psalmist. You have given them dominion over the works of your hands. Compare that to this, subjecting all things under their feet. The emphasis for human beings assessing their role and their place is, look at what we are over. Here the preacher wants to make a point that everything is subject to Jesus. Everything is subject to Jesus. And what does the preacher do? Well, the preacher calls back to the end of the first chapter. This line, subjecting all things under their feet, is in Psalm 8, but it's also already been referenced in the last verse of the previous chapter. It's a reference to Psalm 110, verse 3. So the logic of the sermon, there, I know you sometimes you wonder, is there a logic to anything any preacher says, right? But the logic of the preacher's sermon, the thing he's trying to get to, the point he's trying to make, extends the idea of the dominion human beings have over creation to the lordship of Jesus over all things. In fact, in Psalm 110, the verse says, "The Lord said unto my Lord, sit here at my right hand while I make your enemies your footstool." That is why I bring everything under subjection to Jesus. So the preacher admits to the order of creation, but makes the point that Jesus is greater, is the greater human one. He has position above all things, not just over creation. For the preacher, Jesus is the new Adam. He fills out what the old Adam could not do. Consider it this way. If the preacher put angels in their proper place below Jesus, the preacher also put human beings in their place below Jesus. The point is clear. The descendants of Adam do what the descendants of Adam do. And what do? Well, we always think ourselves capable of providing something new that will aid all people. We'll solve our problems. I just want to know, when has that happened? Well, when has that happened in all of human history? We solved and brought aid to all people. What we turn to consider is this. If the early Christian congregation got tired, even of Jesus, and looked to angels, what have we looked to in our fatigue? If they looked around and decided that the angel story was the better story, no suffering, no death, if they're better to focus their attention on, and the preacher says, mm-mm, no. I don't know anybody who's like treating angels the same way. So the question is for us, what is it that we substitute? What is it that we look to? What story do we look to in our fatigue, in our weariness, in our we're tired of it all? Any idea? I know you like that rhetorically. You answer it first, preacher. Well, it's us. We look to ourselves. We are told to look inward. We're told to see what we have because what we need is already there. Okay. When has that worked? When has that happened? But that is the message today. So the preacher continues, not only has the preacher demonstrated how to read the Scriptures the way Jesus read them, in doing so, the preacher has described the way God reconstructs the order of the world around Jesus rather than around us. You get that? So if David wrote this song about how marvelous it was that God did this for human beings, the preacher's going, wait a minute, I'm telling you that God's done it all right in Jesus. So he shifts the subject of the psalm away from mere mortals to the one who became flesh and blood for us. Dreams for a new world center on how we might imagine a better world. The preacher makes the point that in Jesus, God has ordered the world under the way of Jesus. A way, admittedly, that includes suffering, death, and resurrection. So rather than use the ways common to human beings where power is used to coerce toward a better way, that's really not a better way, God revealed in Jesus gifts us a better way. Gifts us a better way. And even at that, the preacher admits, then and now, we don't see everything in subjection. We don't see everything in subjection to us. I can't get my dog to mind me. He loves me, but I can't get him to not run over to Tony's garage and bark and aggravate his dogs. I can't get him to stop it. Well, we could go on. But we have not the control we think we have. Not everything we think is in subjection to us is. And what the preacher realizes and recognizes is that we've got eyes. And we look around and we go, like, if everything is subject to Jesus, it's sure not looking that way. You agree? Well, if you do, you're right in line. The preacher sucked us all in, hadn't he? He's put everything, made everything subject to Jesus, and yet we look around and we go, And he admits to that, doesn't he? Yeah, we look around and it sure doesn't appear that way. What he invites us to do is look with the eyes of faith to see that the Lord is in the process of subjecting all things. So what we could say is we're living in the until. And that is, in this until, in this period that is waiting until it's fulfilled, we're going to be tired. We're going to be weary. We're going to be tired of it all. We're going to be fatigued. But the congregation is encouraged not to become cynical or skeptical about the future, about the possibilities, about what God has done in Jesus. The congregation is instead to say, but we do see Jesus. But we do see Jesus. God is at work in the world through the message of the cross, bringing all things into subjection to the one who is, he says, now crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering and death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for us. He might taste death for us. The preacher's determined to counter our wondering, our weariness, our tired of it all with the good news of the event that gives us hope. The event. What event? Well, for the preacher, it's the cross of Jesus Christ, the one who suffered and died and then was enthroned. F.F. Bruce quotes John Chrysostom and then John Calvin. Chrysostom was considered one of the best preachers in the history of Christianity. He felt like that the line here of tasting death was such that Jesus was like the physician who knew what the patient needed, and though he didn't need to drink it to prove that it worked, drank it anyway. Calvin came along and he said, by saying every man, taste death for everyone, by saying for every man, he means not only that Christ might be an example of a physician taking the first taste of a bitter draught, that the patient may consent to drink it. He means rather that Christ died for us, and that by taking on himself what was due to us, he redeemed us from the curse of death. The event? The event that the preacher points to say, here's what you and I need to see. Here's what we need to see. Not angels, but the cross. So some years later, Karl Barth would describe much the same thing. The event itself, the event of the cross, testified as such by the apostles, quote, set forth before your eyes, as Paul says in Galatians 3, was through the thin veil of this human mediation, its own proclamation, awakening and sustaining faith. It could be and had to be explained what, quote, the word of the cross was in 1 Corinthians, that it was to preach Christ crucified also in 1 Corinthians, or to show the Lord's death also in 1 Corinthians, but it was already perceived and known even before it was explained. God gave His Son for us all in Romans 8. He gave himself for me in Galatians 2. He suffered for you in 1 Peter 2. He died for us in 1 Thessalonians 5. By the grace of God, he tasted death for every man, Hebrews 2. He gave his life for his friends in John 15. As the good shepherd, he gave his life for the sheep, John 10. In our brother, we have to see the one for whom Christ died, Romans 14. All these and similar sayings are expressions to indicate the passion of Christ, expressions which certainly could be and needed to be interpreted in the eras of New Testament Christians, but which certainly did not sound empty or obscure, but filled out and very clear, not by virtue of faith as a reaction of these men, but by virtue of the event itself. All to say that all of these things that the cross accomplished for us is to point to the event. So when you get tired and I get tired and we get weary and we get tired of each other, we get tired of all of it, we get tired of everything, and we start looking around thinking that, you know, there's got to be a substitute, maybe it's angels, maybe it's us. The preacher says, remember the event of God's greatest expression of love when he gave himself for us all on the cross. That event is what we recall. And that event for New Testament writers is the event that includes his coming, his suffering, his death, and his resurrection. So that we see Jesus, God's gift, the one to whom we give our attention and allegiance to when we are tired and we are wearied and we are fatigued. For he gave that gift to us all, tasting death for us.